moment before beginning our class so that you might utilize the privacy of the priesthood for a rebound if necessary. Shall we pray? Heavenly Father, we are grateful to you for again permitting us the opportunity to continue our spiritual growth. We are grateful for the assets which you have provided. We thank you for this time which you have allotted. And it is our prayer that what we do here this evening will contribute to our spiritual growth. To that end, we lift our prayer in Christ's name. Amen. On Sunday morning, we concluded our study by taking a look at an excerpt from one of the references that I've been throwing at you of lately, Michael Ledeen's book, The War Against Terror Masters. This book was published and copyrighted in 2002, and so the issues that he discusses are probably more advanced now than they were a couple of years ago. And it had to do with the infiltration of this country by terrorists. And the front organization for their training and for their education are mosques and the schools that are associated with them. In the early going of the present conflict in the Middle East, I made reference to it as the Islamic War. And then they put an official title on it called the War on Terror. I still believe that the better title, the more descriptive title, would be the War Against Islam. That is the enemy. And those who are involved in it can't be distinguished. Those who are the actual terrorists can't really be distinguished from those who aren't. Especially in this country where they use the camouflage of a mosque and a school. And so these are the things that we were observing as time caught us on Sunday morning. And we had noted also that the techniques that are being used to teach these young children are equal to the propaganda missives that are communicated daily through the Frankfurt School and our educational institutions, as well as the techniques used to brainwash people literally. The example being the Korean POWs and illustrated quite nicely in the movie The Manchurian Candidate. The points that we made in closing are worth review to get us back into our flow. The delusion of the souls of American Muslim youth is afoot. And with each passing year, a fifth column increases its lethal presence within the Commonwealth. Now, it is, of course, very gingerly that I advance these notions. There are quite a number of books by authorities on terrorism out there, this being only one of them. And I believe that their observations all seem to coincide with these very same ideas. And so this is not in any way, I believe, promoting fear. You should never be afraid. Believers do not have that option of being afraid. That is a sin. Jesus Christ controls history, and you personally have a wall of fire. But it is important that you therefore understand what is going on in the invisible war. You do not need to be co-opted because of ignorance. And ignorance is, of course, the ace trump that is used by those who would propagandize you into believing the lie. So you must have information in order to defend your souls. And as you acquire that information, you become isolated from the problem. Now, our devotion to the foundational principles contained in the First Amendment and others found in the Bill of Rights are the freedoms being used by Islam to destroy us. We are a free society, but we have certain safeguards that have been constructed very nicely and very appropriately by our founders to protect us from a tyrannical government. And therefore, when there are insurgents that utilize these very same protections, then our protections become our weakness. And this has to be kept in mind as we deal with difficult issues that challenge these particular freedoms. And some leeway has to be given in times of warfare, and we most certainly are in a period of warfare. There has to be some flexibility in order to manage the enemy. And that is the great debate that goes on today. Muslims are driven by an inordinate hatred and their obsession to destroy all who do not convert to Islam. If you understand any of the Quran at all, and you have plenty of availability of information on it, it is very clear that these mandates are found within those writings. Now, there are allegedly some more progressive members of Islam who don't necessarily buy into this, but there are enough who do to neutralize their opinions and attitudes. They, if they exist, and I have my doubts as to how large a number they are, but if they exist, they are certainly neutralized by those who are of the terrorist bent. Therefore, they are compartmentalized minions in Lucifer's ongoing effort to destroy client nations in the church age. And when you understand that portion of the invisible war, then you must always, as a citizen of a client nation, keep your eye peeled for those who are going to seek ways to bring down the client nation. And Lucifer organizes compartments within the human population, wherever they might be, but primarily in religion, to co-opt others and then therefore to execute his plan, and that is to bring down client nations. So we should not be surprised that these kinds of things go on under the cover of religion. Such a scheme may achieve various levels of success, but as long as the United States maintains enough pivot power, it cannot succeed. So the question might arise is, well, in view of all of these horrors, these dangers, what should the believer do? And what the believer should do is what you are doing now, and that is to grow in grace. The principle is that Jesus Christ controls history. He will protect you, and He will ultimately protect this nation if there are enough of you. So there is no reason to get upset or disturbed. The only thing that should disturb you is if for some reason you're being distracted from your spiritual growth. And so the solution to this insurgency is spiritual growth among believers. There is a current trend in that direction, but its momentum can be calculated by an increase of interest in sound biblical teachings, and of course that remains to be seen. Just as the Lord puts a wall of fire around believers who respond to truth, He likewise puts a wall of fire around a client nation that hosts these individuals. So the more of you there are, the safer we become, regardless of the plans and the plots of the enemy. But when believers of a client nation begin to buy the lie, the result is a Fabian drift away from the influences that develop individuality and free will into influences that dehumanize and collectivize people. And this spinoff of mature believers results in the administration of simultaneous divine discipline to the individuals, and the collective result is national discipline. And presently, we have a mini revival that appears to be based in values. You oftentimes hear people today speak of values on both sides of the ledger, be they progressives or traditionalists. Well, everyone has values. Bank robbers have values. Their value is that your money is mine and I'm going to get it and I will kill you if you get in the way. Those are values. Now, they're not very high-minded, but nevertheless, that's the code they operate under. And of course, these values are fine if they find their source in the absolute principles of establishment and doctrinal truths found in the Word of God. Now, there is no question that progressives have values, but their values are based on ideologies that developed from the theories of Italian communist Antonio Gramsci. Subscription to his philosophy by present-day progressives is readily apparent to anyone with traditionalist values. Now, there are those who know things are wrong but can't quite put their finger on it. When we were noting the Korean POWs, and as this problem emerged post-Korean War, as we began to analyze the repatriated POWs and how some were able to hold out under the pressure but a third of them were not, the questions that arose from all of that were quite interesting. And most of all, it had to do with why did one-third betray their country? And why did 21 of those one-third choose not to be repatriated? Those were very interesting questions. And as they delved into it, they learned that the communists were using some type of mind infiltration technique. It wasn't quite understood in the beginning, but ultimately they were able to determine that they were using psychological tactics in order to flush establishment viewpoint from these individual souls and then replace these opinions and viewpoints and worldviews with their own. And therefore, they had been transformed into thinking in an entirely different way. To some degree, all the way down to those who bought the entire lie and chose to remain with their captors in the end. The point that was made during all of that is that you can't really fight a problem unless you can put a name on it. And once you can identify it with a name, then you can define it, and then you can isolate it, and then you can recognize it. So when there is a problem, you can't really fight it. You can't really do anything about it. You can't defend yourself against it unless you're able to give it a name and a definition so it can be consistently identified. And that is the case with the concept of progressives and traditionalists. Traditionalists look at progressives without knowing the philosophy behind them and say something's wrong about that, but I can't put my finger on it on every occasion at least. And the progressives have the same problem. They look at traditionalist viewpoint. They know it is in opposition to their philosophies and ideologies, but they can't always put their finger on it. And one of the easiest ways to identify their confusion is when it comes to religion and especially Christianity. They just don't get the Christian mindset. They know they don't like it, but they can't quite understand why. So when they begin discussing it, you look at what they're saying and think, well, that's just wrong. You don't understand. That is wacko. They know they don't like it, but they can't put a name on it, they can't define it, and therefore it's very hard for them to isolate it. The same with many traditionalists who look at progressive viewpoint. But once you are able to put names on things, for example, progressives, we've defined what a progressive is, those who subscribe to Frankfurt philosophy and ideology, as opposed to traditionalists. We've got a name here, and we've defined it. Those who, first of all, subscribe to establishment viewpoint based on Judeo-Christian ethics from a Western European heritage. And, in addition to that, biblical concepts that find their place in that Judeo-Christian ethic. The ethics are one thing, but the doctrines are higher and quite another. And therefore, there's a large body of people in this country who have traditionalist viewpoint that includes both establishment and doctrinal concepts. These people are the real enemies. These are the ones Lucifer needs to bring down. They are his targets. All the rest are collateral damage. Therefore, you're the target. They're not after you bodily as much as they are after you mentally. And if they can propagandize you in such ways that you will buy the lie and therefore turn your back upon on traditionalist concepts, then they have won a victory. The battle is for the soul. It is not a battle that will primarily be fought on turf. It will be fought in the thought processes of the cardia. That is the issue. Now, I want to give you some background on Antonio Gramsci. I pulled this from the Barnes Review of May, June 2004, beginning on page 76, and I need to give a disclaimer for this excerpt. Someone, I have no idea who it is, subscribed to this magazine for me. I never subscribe to it for myself. It just shows up. And after I got the first couple, I realized that the Barnes Review at least has a tendency toward anti-Semitism. I haven't quite nailed them as anti-Semites, but they have articles in there that seem to favor Hitler and Nazism and things of this nature. So I decided that I just would throw them in the garbage can, and hopefully the subscription would soon run out. It turns out the issue I just received, they warned me, would be the final one. Let's hope so. But along the way, when I got this particular issue, there on the cover, it had this article it promoted on the inside about Antonio Gramsci. And I thought, well, I'll read that. And it turned out to be helpful, and I think it's a good contribution to our study. The article is simply entitled Antonio Gramsci. It's written by Joseph Crossan in that May, June 2004 issue. Here we go. One of the many theories conceived by Gramsci was, quote, the long march through the institutions. Now, that is the key to Frankfurt philosophy and to progressive ideology, the long march through the institutions. Now, you memorize that phrase, And then when you see it played out on the news or in your daily life or at your local school or in local government or nationally or what have you, you can say that is a part of the long, slow march through the institutions. Now, let me give you some examples. The long march through the institutions raises the question of what are these institutions? And I would say that they are primarily the divine institutions. You therefore find within this progressive ideology an assault, first of all, on free will, the volition of the individual. And there is a transformation away from individual responsibility in this country over to group dependability, group think, and therefore getting away from individual concepts within our philosophy, our traditionalist ideas of the individual and his responsibility to himself and his family. That is being eroded by progressive thought. That is a long march through that institution. Next, we have marriage. There's a long march through that institution that has begun in this country some while ago, and it's got a head of steam now. The authority of the husband was one of the first things that came under assault because that is considered to be authoritarian. It breeds authoritarian images and attitudes, allegedly, and also it puts people in a type of slavery, as it is so defined. The women are suppressed, and the children learn this, and the little boys become tyrants when they grow up, and the ladies, they carry on the imagery of their mother who was in alleged slavery. You get the drift, you know about it. The assault on the divine institution of the marriage. The husband, by definition in Scripture, is the CEO of that corporation. It is a corporate relationship. It in no way implies any kind of demeaning of women, much less the wife. The wife is a part of the corporation, but all corporations have a leader, and God has decreed that the husband has the final vote on certain issues that come before the marriage. There's certainly a place for discussion of issues dependent upon what they are, but ultimately when a final decision has to be made, the husband has that responsibility. Now, he may defer to his wife in the making of that decision, but he is held responsible for the outcome by God. He is the one who is accountable. And so if he transfers authority to his wife and says, "Darling, you run the show," fine. But whatever decisions she makes, he is going to be held responsible. He will be held accountable before the Lord. That's the way the system works. And you see that in corporations. If you have a CEO that really doesn't pay much attention to what's going on, and he delegates it down to people below him and doesn't keep up and doesn't really follow up on their decisions, and things go wrong, guess who gets fired? It's him. He gets fired because he was responsible. He is the one that is accountable. And that's the way the system works in marriage from the biblical viewpoint. And so the authority of the husband comes under assault. Now, one of the ramifications of that is that there's a loss of control within the family, and therefore easy divorce has emerged over the last several decades. And then we move into premarital sex. Premarital sex is quite popular today. It seems as though it's a requirement before someone can decide whether they want to get married or not. Another spinoff of this is the popularity of pornography. From this comes the promotion of homosexuality as another lifestyle, not necessarily an alternate lifestyle. It is placed on an equal par, that type of relationship, an equal par with that of a man-woman marriage. And then ultimately, we have seen recently the attack on marriage by inserting homosexual unions and the desire for these to be elevated to the level of marriage. The third divine institution is the family, and the authority of the parents has come under great assault of late. The authority of the parents is oftentimes challenged by laws that are passed and implemented oftentimes in local schools, where teachers usurp the authority of parents by allowing children to do certain things that parents are not allowed to know. And you're familiar with some of these. Drugs enters into it. When children can be brought into the drug culture, then that is destructive to the family and to parental authority. In fact, the use of drugs is a direct rejection of parental authority in most cases. Now, I hasten to add that there's so many parents today who came out of the 1960s drug culture. They are involved in drugs themselves, and they don't really have much care whether their children are involved or not. In fact, I know for a fact that, and this was several years ago, but I can tell you that several of the biggest drug distribution operations in this city are the local high schools, and they have the best prices. I was told by a young person one time that there were classmates that he had that bought drugs at school for their parents because they could get the better price at the school. So we do have a problem in that we have whacked out parents who are on drugs, and therefore they can't control their children, and they have the incorrect notion that because they used drugs way back when, they shouldn't tell their children they can't. So once you use drugs, for whatever the reason, you diminish your ability to control its use by your children later on. There's a guilt complex involved and all of the rest. This is detrimental to the family and plays right into Lucifer's hands and is being promoted by progressive ideology. Then there is sex ed. I won't bother you with my bloviations about sex ed tonight, but you know my feelings on that. I think it is absolutely horrible that they bring up such subjects in a public or private school. That is a subject for parents and churches. The church is the place to learn about sex education, and the Bible has a lot to say about it. And the parents, on the other hand, if they're not religious types, then they should know enough about it to train their children properly. And that's something that, of course, could be addressed for quite some while. The other problem that the schools present is obviously Frankfurt philosophy. This is progressivism unleashed, and it is growing in its power and its influence on a year-by-year basis as every graduating class that emerges from a high school, that degree of Frankfurt philosophy is now infused into the population, into the national thought process. It affects elections, it affects the way people behave in their lives, and it affects the way Jesus Christ controls history with regard to this country. And so there's a transfer also of authority from parents to teachers. Teachers have the power to make decisions for children without advising parents or consulting parents. Curriculum oftentimes inserts psychoanalysis into the curriculum at the expense of academic discipline. And therefore, there is a de-emphasis on academics as a result. The fourth divine institution is nationalism, and we have seen over the last several decades a de-emphasis on patriotism to the point to where those who are patriotic are considered to be radicals. There's an emphasis, therefore, instead on a one-world type of concept. Pacifism is the principle behind that. Environmentalism is also a part of this. Environmentalism, as far as Lucifer is concerned, remember, he coordinates all movements and all alleged conspiracies. And therefore, as far as environmentalism is concerned, it is for Lucifer a rhetorical veil. The hidden agenda is the capture of property rights to be turned over to the government. If the government can control your land and your water, you don't have free use of your land. Therefore, environmentalism is an evil and is an attack on nationalism. Junk science, of course, is involved in the attack on nationalism. This comes from all the way from evolution to global warming. Here's how evolution is an issue here. If you subscribe to evolution, then history doesn't matter. Evolution implies that the human species is consistently getting better and better and smarter and more advanced. Therefore, the opinions and the ideas that were grounded in past societies and civilizations have no impact because these people obviously were less advanced than we are. We are the smartest ones ever because we exist at this far end of the genetic chain, and therefore because we're so brilliant, historical experiences really don't matter. And that therefore contributes to the downfall of the client nation. Global warming is a rhetorical veil, again, part of the environmentalist movement in order to convince you that your property can be controlled by the government. And then there, of course, the philosophies of multiculturalism, diversity, and political correctness. And these have been infused into our legal process so that we are handicapped now in our ability to fight terror. These three things, multiculturalism, diversity, and political correctness, handicap our ability to deal with terrorism. And therefore, the principle has emerged from all of this of the equality of all cultures and especially of all religions. Therefore, Christianity is no better or worse than Islam, Hinduism, Buddhism, Wiccaism, Taoism, you name it. We're all the same. We're all just religions worshiping our own self-invented God. It's all mythology and really is a problem-creating machine that needs to be stopped and done away with. Religion, therefore, is an evil regardless of its stripe, and there is great opposition toward all religion presently except for Islam. By the progressive viewpoint. Also, open borders is an obvious assault on client nation stability. Now, that is just a few examples of the long march through the institutions. One of the many theories conceived by Gramsci was, quote, the long march through the institutions. What Gramsci knew was that most people generally gravitate toward the familiar, be it physical habits or intellectual ideals. And we've studied that in facilitated wheel tracks. You go to what you know. You go to what's easy. You go to what you've always done. And to change these facilitated wheel tracks takes time and, quote, education. And if you're educated long enough, you will diminish the behavior patterns that you've relied on in the past and then start to depend on others. Now, we attempt to do that here under Romans 12:2 in the renovation of the soul. That's how you grow in grace. Lucifer has his own grace apparatus for perception, and that is the communication of the lie. And if you believe the truth, then those wheel tracks must be diminished. They must be shrunk up so that he can then feed you the lie and those become facilitated. And now you begin to agree with the cosmic philosophy. And that's what is being stated here. What Gramsci knew was that most people generally gravitate toward the familiar, be it physical habits or intellectual ideals. The key would then become the process of changing what the culture finds familiar. That's what the long march is all about. It can't be done overnight, and he realized that. And so his concept was, let's build a system that can get itself infused into the culture and then chip away at established concepts, therefore ultimately changing the way people think. And when that's done, then people capitulate willingly. They agree with the change. They are the change. They think the change, and now things are all different, and there has not been one drop of blood shed. At least in theory. By changing the very essence of what thoughts and ideals people find to be familiar, a movement could then affect the changes on the large scale that it could not realize through armed revolution. And how did he arrive at this? Gramsci and some of his buddies that emerged in the Frankfurt philosophy observed the Russian Revolution. And Russia never, the Soviet Union, never really reached that summum bonum that it dreamed of. The people were suppressed, they were oppressed, and ultimately depressed. They could not function because there was no freedom. And therefore, it was an economic catastrophe. Reagan realized this, and through his leadership, they were brought down and thus destroyed. But what he noted, what Gramsci noted and others, about the Russian Revolution was that they sought to change society by warfare, by revolution, by bloodshed, by force. And he realized the reason this is not working is because the people may be forced into the change, but they don't necessarily agree with it. Their minds were not changed. They physically are involved in the change, but they're not involved mentally. And what we must do to win this ball game is to get people to change mentally so you don't need the physical force. And so everything is in the invisible war as a result of Gramsci's observations. A long march through an institution means the unhappy segment of society, instead of seizing control through infiltration of a small but critical segment of the state apparatus to displace current controllers, would choose rather to seize power from within the system. Work with the system. Get into the system. Join the system. Once power is assumed, and that may take a while to do, but once power is assumed, existing lines of authority and habits of obedience, already inherent in legitimate government, would be utilized to advance the coup's illegitimate aims. Now, let me give you some examples of that. I want to read that to you again and then give you an example. An illustration would be good here. A long march through the institution means the unhappy segment of society, these are the progressives in our example, instead of seizing control through infiltration of a small but critical segment of the state apparatus to displace current controllers, would choose to seize power from within the system. Once power is assumed, existing lines of authority and habits of obedience, already inherent in legitimate government, would be utilized to advance the coup's illegitimate aims. Okay, let's take the Bill of Rights. Let's use it. And let's go to the First Amendment. And let's take freedom of speech. Let's use freedom of speech to its hilt in order to promote the ideas that we want to get across to people who think differently than we, who are presently in authority, but who we need to convince. And there's no way they can stop us because they have been trained to subscribe to freedom of speech no matter what is said. We will use freedom of speech, therefore, to convey our ideas that the majority and those in the power are opposed to, and there's nothing they can do about it. Separation of church and state, therefore, becomes a good illustration. Here is a public lie that the Constitution promotes the idea of a separation of church and state. It does not. It simply says that Congress cannot create a state religion. That is precisely what it says, and only Congress is held accountable there, not the states. And originally, the states even had state religions, state churches. And they ultimately decided that wasn't working out, but that's a state decision. They can make decisions on a state level as they so please, and that's the freedom states were given in the very beginning of our republic. The separation of church and state, therefore, became an issue. Then we have the issue from the Declaration of Independence that we're all created equal. We will take that concept and we will promote that through freedom of speech. We're all created equal. This was a phrase written by Thomas Jefferson, but he had a big opponent at that time. His name was Fisher Ames. And whenever that phrase was quoted, quoting Thomas Jefferson, he always amended it by adding, "but differ greatly in the sequel." All men are created equal, but they differ greatly in the sequel. Once you're born equal under the law. But after that, you're on your own, individual responsibility, and therefore there's great differences among each individual as they use their free will to make choices in life, and they either move forward or they retrogress. And therefore, in the sequel, meaning post-physical birth, there's a great bit of difference in this created equal concept. Civil rights is something that we all immediately would subscribe to, that we have civil rights. And so this was latched on to. Civil rights, we have a right to certain things. Well, you have a right to a lot of things, but not everything that's fallen under the aegis of civil rights. But few people are willing to argue the case because no one wants to suppress any other's rights. And therefore, they use this in order to move us in a progressive drift. There is, of course, the women's body. This has to do with the abortion concept, and they're given a right to their body, but at the expense of an emerging individual. Once past viability, which is a medical concept, usually beginning in the third trimester, that means that a child is generally capable of surviving away from mother dependence after viability occurs, and therefore once an abortion is attempted in the third trimester, it should be for the delivery of the child, not its termination. And we've studied that in a bit of detail in the past. We also have the concept of the Pledge of Allegiance not having God in it. This goes back to the concept of the separation of church and state, which is not a constitutional issue. But that public lie has been sold so broadly that people now buy that idea and are willing to sacrifice in certain areas expressions of religious confidence in public. The Pledge of Allegiance being one of them. Postings of the Ten Commandments in public places and so on. I hurry to remind you, the Ten Commandments is posted on the wall of the Supreme Court behind where the justices sit. And nobody has complained about that yet. Homosexuals' right to marry is being bandied about, and therefore the equality concept comes in. Our rights should be equal with those of married people, and so that concept is spread about. This concept, therefore, seeks to bring homosexuals into the marriage institution. Women in the military, I hate to even broach that subject, but it's a horrible idea as when it comes to combat. I understand women are being placed in combat in Iraq. It is wrong. It is evil. It is tragic. It should not happen. And we should be embarrassed. Every man in this country should be embarrassed that there are women in harm's way in Iraq. There are many ways in which women can function wonderfully in the armed services, but not in combat. That is embarrassing. Global warming, environmentalism, or other concepts. Now let me read the sentence to you again, and there are some examples for you. Once power is assumed, existing lines of authority and habits of obedience, the lines of authority, let's take the Bill of Rights was my illustration, and habits of obedience, we do not want to challenge the Bill of Rights or its freedoms that it supplies us, already inherent in legitimate government, would be utilized to advance the coup's illegitimate aims. Typically, this march through an institution would take place from the bottom up. Patience is needed to silently weave the seditious ideals and philosophies needed to allow a proper anchor to set within the masses. So they have great patience over a long period of time, thus the phrase, the long march through the institutions. Those masses will soon be set to attacking and branding the non-duped conservative elements as hopelessly behind the times. And there you sit. And you've heard this accusation many times of late. If you have conservative, traditionalist viewpoints, biblical viewpoints, you're branded as someone who is out of step with the times. You're living in the Middle Ages. You're a religious fanatic. You're not up with the advances of science and so on. Those masses will soon be set to attacking and branding the non-duped conservative elements as hopelessly behind the times and even worse, a traitor. Opponents of this coup should be labeled as isolationists who are misguided and dangerous individuals, unable to move into the future and accept the wonderful changes the future will bring. See, that's an environmentalist concept. We're all getting better and smarter. And as we get better and smarter with each passing generation, there's no reason to look to the past. The past was run by people far less able than we. We're the brilliant ones. We have the progressive ideas. We can fix all the world's problems. That is Lucifer's ball game. To be like the Most High, to create a man-made millennium, and he's trying to sell it through environmentalism and evolutionist theology. The long march removes the risk inherent to an armed takeover of a government or institution by removing the possibility of forcing the rank and file with their natural tendency toward protecting and gravitating to the familiar, not accepting the new regime. What it does, if patience prevails, is almost guarantee success because the group targeted for the coup will not only offer little or no resistance, but will also quite likely provide itself as the most effective asset of the coup. And we're doing that in this country. We're saying, oh no, we can't in any way turn our attention toward the obvious enemy, which are the Arabs and the Islamic infusion. We can't do that. That would be politically incorrect. So we willingly cooperate with this entire idea. Now, I mentioned this on Sunday. Let's pause for a moment and let's be racist for a moment, as for the purpose of illustration, of course. When you go to the marketplace, to the movie, you go to the store to shop for groceries, you go anywhere you go in society and you see someone who dresses and presents themselves in Islamic attire, what do you think? Be honest. Do you just assume that they're just another member of the society, our multicultural melting pot, and that they are assimilated into the American culture and can be trusted? Possibly so. But you don't know, do you? You don't know. And they could be among those. You know, the terrorists of 9/11 lived among us for a decade, some of them did. They went where we go. They did what we do. They lived the life we live, and we saw nothing out of the ordinary. So let me read that phrase again, that sentence. What it does, if patience prevails, is almost guarantee success, because the group targeted for the coup will not only offer little to no resistance, but will also quite likely provide itself as the most effective asset for the coup. The law of war is simply stated, know the enemy. An opponent will not fight if he either cannot see or does not realize an enemy is before his very eyes. Pretty good excerpt from an anti-Semitic organization. And I don't know that they are. It just seems like there's a trend in that magazine in that direction. So I just didn't want it. But it proved valuable for that excerpt. Now, point 18. Gramsci understood that the long march must include, in its advance, an assault on Christianity. So we see both barrels aimed at Christianity today. I mean, they are down to getting the job done now. Now Christianity is under frontal assault. When I was growing up, this goes back quite a while, but I remember when the communist threat was out there, I was in school. And there was the notion presented by some teacher somewhere, I forget who it was, that there might come a day where there would be an assault in this country on our Christian faith, and that there would be those who would try to suppress the Christian religion in this country. And I had a friend who laughed at that. Now, it made sense to me. I was raised by a father who was very traditional, so I picked these things up early. But my friend apparently had not picked up on these things. And he said, they will never happen in this country. It is not possible. The people will not permit it. Well, that was probably, I don't know, 40 years ago. Look at it now. Christianity is under direct assault, and Christians are being besmirched and belittled and demeaned and degraded by the progressives. And nothing much is being said about it. In fact, those who lead the assault are the Frankfurt-trained media. Let's get some info on this from B.K. Aikman's Cloning of the American Mind, Eradicating Morality Through Education. Antonio Gramsci, writing on the importance of fomenting revolution among the intellectuals of the West, observed that after the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917, that the same kind of revolution could not be brought about among Western workers because of the close alignment between their form of government and their Christian and Jewish idealism. That's establishment truth. You can't force these people into that deal. They have establishment orientation and they are authority oriented. They will submit to the standards that are typical of Western society. Public opinion, he said, would first have to be turned against biblical injunctions and precepts before a change of worldview could be inculcated. You have to flush the soul of biblical truth before you can insert the lie. He got it. And you just can't go in and force Western thought, people who subscribe to Western thought, to do something that goes against their trends. They're not going to do it. And you'll have to fight a war to get them to do it, and you're right back at the Bolshevik Revolution, and you've learned that won't work.
So we have to go through a long march through the institutions. And in order to do that, the first thing that has to be assaulted is to extract from their thought process Christian injunctions and precepts. And once that is done, then you can bring a change of worldview. And you do that through inculcation, read education. Charles A. Reich's The Greening of America is basically a restatement of Gramsci's theories. How many of you are old enough to remember the 1960s and Charles A. Reich's The Greening of America? He was a barefoot professor at Yale. He strutted about campus barefooted. And he was one of the leaders of the Let's Be Free, Freedom Now deal of the radical 60s. And The Greening of America is nothing but a statement of hippieism. And, of course, its foundational thought was Gramscism. That's who Charles Reich is. Now, The Greening of America is basically a restatement of Gramsci's theories, describing a new kind of revolution that does not require violence. That's what these people mean when they say no war, peace now. They're against violence. Why are they against violence? When violence erupts from the common man in defense of his values based on establishment and biblical truth, that brings to a halt the advance of the progressive idea. They cannot agree to any form of warfare. It stops the progressive movement. Therefore, that's why they're peaceniks. I'll just read it again. The Greening of America is basically a restatement of Gramsci's theories, describing a new kind of revolution that does not require violence to succeed, or indeed violence to resist it, since it depends entirely on mind control and psychological warfare. Now, I keep feeling I have to give disclaimers here for those who know nothing of the 60s. You have no idea what it was like, some of you. I lived through it. I went to college in the 60s. I've seen this up front and personal. I know that what is being stated here is absolutely true. Professors at university in the 1960s and since subscribe to Frankfurt philosophy and the concepts and ideas that I've been reviewing for you here this evening. And it presently goes on at universities in America. It is even more powerful today. And they're after your soul. And when you send your children to university today, you are putting them right in the heart of hell. And they better be prepared when they go to defend their souls. I got an email today from an individual. I'll protect the person's privacy. An email today from an individual who is in university, in this congregation, who is confronting Frankfurt philosophy at his institution. And the person knows enough doctrine to identify the lie. And all this individual was doing was requesting more information, and I tried my best to get it to him. How many have that armor in the soul when they go to university? How many have that inventory of ideas when they can see the professor in front of the classroom selling a lie? You can't challenge that professor. You can enter into debate, but just so far you can go in the classroom before it affects your grade. Be prepared if you are a young person and you have a desire to go to university, you must know your doctrine. Now, you don't challenge these people. If you're allowed the privilege of debate, that's fine. And in this classroom, they were allowed the privilege of debate. But you don't challenge the authority. I told my children, learn what they teach. Just write it down and memorize it and spew it back on the test. Make your A and then forget everything you ever knew about that subject. That's how you outfox them. You'll graduate summa cum laude. You'll graduate with honors, and you retain nothing of the bilge that was propagandized your way. Smart people can outfox these people, and especially if they know doctrine. The nucleus of the Frankfurt group was a mixture of Marxist ideologists, Freudian sexologists, social and political psychologists, and professional propagandists. The school's key treatise was entitled Studies on Authoritarianism and Family, which was the collective works of the Frankfurt School published in Paris in 1936. Are we surprised at that? Max Horkheimer was director of the Frankfurt School in Germany during its pivotal years of the 1930s. Horkheimer's primary thesis was that authority in the family was a problem and deserved serious study. Under his tutelage, the resources of the school were channeled into the study of authoritarianism. What is authoritarianism? It is any system of authority, government down to the family, and anything in between. There are people who don't like authority. We have them in this church. We have them in this city. We have them in this state and nation. There's a lot of people that don't like systems of authority. Unions are good examples of that. They can't stomach the idea that someone actually can tell them what they can and can't do, so they form a mob and call it a union, and then enter into contracts so they can get the management and the ownership under their thumbs. And people will rebut that and say, well, there was a time unions were good because the people were taking advantage of the workers and so on. Well, I don't know how to debate that. I'm not an authority on unions. But I am authority on reading about them today, and they are tyrannical. And I was given the opportunity of joining a union down in Houston when I was in the bread business. I said, well, no. I don't care to, thank you. And then they came to me, the union boss, there at the bakery, and wanted to know why. I said, I don't believe in unions. I think they're evil. He says, well, we go to bat for you. We're the ones who get the salary you've got. I said, look, if it were not for you, I'd probably be making more money because I'm far more qualified for a salary way beyond this one that you got for me. So get out of my face about what you've done for me. I'd preferred to have negotiated on my own. That ended that conversation. Now, unlike some locales in the country, they didn't take me out back and kill me. I didn't get the concrete boots for the river. I may now, but I doubt if the union people listen to this. Nevertheless, what you have here is a rejection of authority systems. You go to a job and they have company policy and you don't like it, and therefore you don't abide by it. And then people say, well, you have to do it, and you say, I won't, and we fire you, and you can't fire me, I'll sue. And therefore everybody goes to court because this person simply can go in and go by company policy. The policy may well have been dumber than dirt. But your challenge is to get in the system, just like Gramsci told you, get in the system and make a long march through it. And when you get in a position of authority where you can have input on the policy, you can make a suggestion or two. And someday they may say, well, let's try your policy out and see how it works. And if it's successful, you may get a raise rather than being fired. The family, therefore, is under assault because it is an authoritarian institution. Horkheimer's primary thesis was that authority in the family was a problem and deserved serious study. Under his tutelage, the resources of the school were channeled into the study of authoritarianism and how to eradicate its ideological underpinnings. Assault the divine institutions, obviously. And we'll see that in a moment. Horkheimer wrote in Studies on Authority in the Family that, quote, the family in crisis produces the attitudes which predispose men for blind submission, which means obey those who are in authority over you, like your parents, for example. He believed, listen to this, this will be our concluding sentence for the night. He believed that capitalism was rooted in the patriarchal concept of society and that any population revering, number one, family strength, 2, national sovereignty. 3, disciplined children. And 4, rationality. We're displaying authoritarian characteristics. Now, let's analyze the things that Horkheimer points out here. The first is family strength. The four things mentioned are the four divine institutions. The first thing mentioned is family strength, that is the marriage. Number 2 is national sovereignty, that's nationalism and patriotism. Number 3 is discipline to children, that's home and family. Number 4 is rationality. That has to do with your free will, your volition, based on truth, to make your own decisions. All of that. See, submission to a set of standards is considered to be an authoritarian concept that must be diminished. These people not only are evil, they obviously, to me, are minions of Lucifer in his warfare against the Christian mind, Christian doctrine, Christian theology, and in effect, because of that assault, he is at war successfully at the moment against this client nation. Now, bring all of these things to your attention so that you can understand the context of the things we're noting in our study. Now, we have other things to note along the way, but we'll have to stop this evening. It's a good place to do so. And we'll resume our study at this point on Thursday evening. Now, Heavenly Father, we're grateful to you for your mercies to us, the fact that you have sustained this nation for so long, and you've sustained it while it's been under the assault of Luciferian concepts. The defense is your perfect word. But that word is, of course, ineffectual unless it is on the launching pad of individual believer souls who therefore can make decisions with regard to your divine viewpoint, and at the same time defend their souls against incoming propaganda from the dark side. Knowing that this is the victory, may we be motivated to continue our pursuit of truth as we seek to be a more efficient soldier for Christ in the invisible war. And we lift our prayer in His name. Amen.